Hello, and thank you for joining us today on Grant County Coronavirus Update here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM, live from downtown Silver City, New Mexico, and online at gmcr.org. I'm your host for today, Marcus Hansen. On this week's Grant County Coronavirus Update, Jamie Newton will be interviewing Dr. Fred Fox, a family and public health physician who has lived in Grant County for 33 years. They'll be discussing guidance for self-care and care for families in the community, how parts of the coronavirus vaccines work, long-term consequences of the disease, and more. But first, the news. And the New Mexico Department of Health on Tuesday announced 1,313 new cases of the coronavirus. This is from last week, from a total of 191,377 cases, with 29 additional deaths, for a total of 3,932 deaths here in New Mexico. 110 individuals do remain hospitalized in New Mexico, which is a decrease of 17 from last week. And as of Tuesday, 44.2% of New Mexicans have received their first dose of the two-shot vaccine for COVID-19, while 27.3% have been fully vaccinated. This is according to the COVID-19 vaccine dashboard. In Grant County, the Department of Health has reported 23 new cases since last week. This is for a total of 1,613 cases in Grant County. There are 183 active cases in the county as of Tuesday, which is a drop from 4, and no deaths have been reported here in Grant County in the last week. 35 people in Grant County have lost their lives due to COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic 1 year ago. The Department of Health also reports 45.7% of Grant County residents are partially vaccinated and 23% are fully vaccinated. 54% of the county is registered for the vaccine as of Tuesday. In other news, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky signed a declaration determining that the evictions of tenants could be detrimental to public health control measures to slow the spread of COVID-19 and has issued a temporary halt in residential evictions through January 30th. Separately, due to the national public health emergency caused by the coronavirus disease, the U.S. Department of Agriculture today announced the temporary suspension of past due debt collections and foreclosures for distressed borrowers under the Farm Storage Facility Loan and the Direct Farm Loan programs administered by the Farm Service Agency. The temporary suspension is in place until further notice and is expected to continue while the National COVID-19 Disaster Declaration is in place. Beginning April 5th, the state of New Mexico will grant approximately $170 million of federal aid and for rental and utility assistance to households experiencing financial hardships due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Emergency Rental Assistance Program is available to renters across the state. Find out more at renthelpnm.org. Again, that's renthelpnm.org. HMS school-based clinics are now open Tuesdays and Thursdays, where students K through 12 can be seen for mental health and medical appointments. In addition, any faculty, staff, and even substitutes can be seen for medical appointments. The Silver High Clinic can be reached by phone at 575-534-1015. Again, that's for the Silver High Clinic. For the Cobre High Clinic, call 575-537-5069. The New Mexico Department of Health on Monday announced that New Mexicans 75 years of age or older who are registered at vaccinenm.org will no longer need event codes to schedule vaccine appointments. Instead, seniors will receive invitations to schedule appointments, and at that point, they will log into the vaccinenm.org website using their confirmation code and date of birth and schedule an appointment at a time and location that is convenient for them. No event code will be required, but they will still need to make an appointment to receive the vaccine. Those requiring additional assistance with registration or scheduling can dial 1-855-600-3453. Again, 1-855-600-3453. Press option 0 for vaccine questions and option 4 for tech support. On a local level, the town of Silver City is now offering a hotline and email address to help Grant County residents register for the vaccine, identify people in our community who are homebound, or have difficulty getting out to a vaccination site, and just vaccine help in general. This number can be reached at 575-597-7029. Again, that's 575-597-7029. And you can also email grantcountynmcares@gmail.com. That is, again, grantcountynmcares@gmail.com. A reminder, the following groups are currently eligible for the vaccine. This includes hospital personnel, residents and staff of long-term care facilities, medical first responders, congregate setting workers, persons providing direct medical care and other in-person services, rather, home-based healthcare and hospice workers, persons 75 years of age or older, persons 16 and older with chronic health conditions or a disability, educators, early childhood professionals, and other school staff, frontline essential workers, residents of congregate care facilities, New Mexicans age 60 and older, and other essential workers. The State Department of Health announced last week that the launch of the COVID-19 exposure notification system, called the NM Notify app, when activated on a smartphone, the app alerts individuals when they have been exposed to someone with who has verified that they are infected with COVID-19. To learn more about the NM Notify exposure notification app, go to nmnotify.com. The state's red to turquoise public health order, in which counties are evaluated over a two-week period for daily cases and test positivity rates, will be updated next Wednesday on April 7th. Currently, 11 counties are turquoise, 10 are green, and 10 are yellow. Grant County is in the yellow. Hidalgo Medical Services is making testing available Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at both their Silver City and Lordsburg locations. If you're in Silver City, call 575-388-1511 to schedule an appointment. And if you're in Lordsburg, call 575-542-8384. Again, that's 575-542-8384 if you're in Lordsburg. Additionally, the Grant County Public Health Office and the Hidalgo County Public Health Offices are providing free testing for COVID-19. The Grant County Public Health Office provides testing Tuesdays 8 to 10 in the morning and then 2 to 4 in the afternoon. In Hidalgo County, they are conducted Thursday from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. To register for either, you can go online to cvtestreg.nmhealth.org. And to find out more ways to get tested, you can go to grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org. Now we'll look at some financial resources for those in need. The Treasury Department and the IRS announced that the federal income tax filing due date for individuals for the 2020 tax year will be automatically extended from April 15th of this year to May 17th of this year. This also applies to New Mexico 2020 personal income taxes as well. And if you are looking for some help with taxes, the WNMU School of Business is providing volunteer income tax assistance. And that is available through our Mondays and Wednesdays through April 15th. The services are available to those making $57,000 or less, or those who are 65 years of age or older. Returns will not be done in person. Instead, you will have to drop them off at the drop-off site, which is located on the west entrance of Light Hall. Detailed information regarding needed items and drop-off information is found at wnmu.edu/events. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, assistance is available to those who are not traditionally eligible for unemployment and benefits. The State Department of Workforce Solutions has opened an application for mixed earners unemployment compensation as of Wednesday, March 10th. The compensation provides $100 in extra benefits to individuals with at least $5,000 in net income from self-employment in the tax year prior to the initial unemployment insurance claim. To find out more, go to dws.state.nm.us. The New Mexico Taxation and Revenue Department has begun issuing $600 rebates for certain eligible recipients of the Working Families Tax Credits. The one-time rebates are available to taxpayers who are not dependents, who receive the Working Families Tax Credit, and who have an adjusted gross income of $31,200 or less. For single filers, for married filing jointly, or heads of household, it is $39,000. Taxpayers who have already filed their 2020 state tax return are eligible for the $600 rebate do not need to take any further action. The $600 rebate will be mailed to them or delivered by direct deposit if they have selected that option when filing for their 2020 tax return. If you'd like to find out more, just go to tax.newmexico.gov. The temporary gross receipts tax relief authorized by Senate Bill 1 allows many restaurants, bars, breweries, and similar businesses a gross receipts tax deduction for sales prepared for food and drinks made after March 1, 2021 and prior to July 1st of this year. The tax relief is intended to help businesses that have been hit hard, especially financially during the COVID-19 pandemic. During the four-month period that the deduction is available, eligible businesses may choose either not to change gross receipts tax on the deductible receipts or to charge the tax but keep the amount charged. Fast food restaurants are not eligible for the deduction, but mobile food services do qualify. More information, including how the deduction will be claimed, is available on the forms and publications page of, as previously mentioned, tax.newmexico.gov. PNM is extending help for families, small businesses, and nonprofits struggling to pay their electricity bill. The PNM COVID Customer Relief Fund helps eligible customers pay down or even pay off their past due PNM bill. The funding has been extended to today, March 31st. Again, today is the last day to apply due to the number of customers that are still experiencing financial hardship from the pandemic. Access the application while funds are still available by calling PNM at 855-364-2950. Again, that's 855-364-2950. And that's between the hours of 7:30 and 6 p.m. Again, that you have until today. If you'd like to go online, you can go to pnmcovd.powerclerk.com. Again, that is pnmcovd.powerclerk.com. Now a look at the food pantry schedules. The Common Center for Food Security and Sustainability will be holding their next regular food pantry distributions for the Silver City, Tyrone, and Arenas Valley areas today, Wednesday, the last Wednesday of the month. That's March 31st from 4 to 6 p.m. And they'll also be holding another one this Saturday, April 3rd from 10 a.m. to noon. The Commons is located at 501 East 13th Street here in Silver City, which is just off Swan Street behind the Knights of Columbus building. For more information, please contact the Commons at 575-388-2988 or visit the website thecommonsgrantcounty.org. And lastly, the Gospel Mission here in Silver City is located at 111 South Texas Street, and they offer a Monday through Friday breakfast food pantry from 9 to 10 and a lunch food pantry Monday through Saturday from noon to 1. If you'd like to find out more about the other services they offer, it is 575-388-5071 or go down to 111 South Texas Street. Again, that's for the Gospel Mission. And for these resources and more, please go to grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org and do please consider signing up to their newsletter, which is released weekly. Next up, Jamie Newton is joined by Dr. Fred Fox, a family and public health physician who has lived in Grant County for 33 years. They'll be discussing guidance for self-care and care for families in the community, how parts of the coronavirus vaccine work, and long-term consequences of the disease and more.
This is the Coronavirus Update interview of March 31, 2021 on Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico. I'm Jamie Newton, your host for today. My guest is Dr. Fred Fox, MD, a family and public health physician who has lived in Grant County, New Mexico for 33 years. He practiced medicine in Silver City for many years, and for the past 17 years, he's been the medical director of the health department in Greenlee County, Arizona, right next door to us. In that position, he has major responsibility for coordinating healthcare and the county's public health response to the coronavirus pandemic. Our program today will cover a broad range of topics, including realities of the coronavirus pandemic, vaccines to help us overcome it with fewer illnesses and deaths, the continuing need for coronavirus safe practices, or CSPs, you may have heard them called, and the contest between science-based education and misinformation or even disinformation to win hearts and minds as the pandemic runs its course. Dr. Fox, thank you for being with us on Coronavirus Update.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Jamie. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
The coronavirus pandemic is a global crisis with many moving parts. Major changes often come in rapid succession. Record new infection rates in Brazil, new surges in parts of Europe, a return to shutdown restrictions in countries that were lauded for their success reducing the spread of the virus only weeks ago, emergence of highly infectious variants where they were not previously found. Dr. Fred Fox, please give us an overview of pandemic conditions as you understand them currently, worldwide, nationally, and here in our region of the American Southwest.
Well, we had been looking at a decrease in cases worldwide, and we're hoping that as the summer months approach, that this would continue. Unfortunately, the situations you mentioned are occurring across the world, primarily due to a combination of the emergence of these resistant new variants, or more transmissible variants, and the perhaps premature uplifting of the public health mitigation efforts, which had helped control. And in some countries, such as Brazil, where there were really not very effective mitigation efforts implemented. This is concerning because we would hope that the summer would start to show us a whole different situation, knowing that in the fall and subsequent winter, we might see an uptick. But as you mentioned, Europe, Brazil, some other countries are seeing an increase. And we're worried here in this country that we will as well. Although we had seen a significant decrease in number of cases and in deaths, both of those have leveled off. And in fact, nationally, there's been an increase in the last couple of weeks of several percentage points of the number of cases of COVID-19. That is concerning because it could be followed by an increase in deaths as well. We have had stabilized in terms of the number of deaths, but we're still on course to end up by the time summer gets here, of having had close to 600,000 deaths from COVID-19. And that's so concerning and it's been so devastating for those families. It far exceeds the number of deaths that occurred to servicemen and servicewomen in the entire 4 years of World War II. And it rapidly approaching the number of U.S. citizens who died during the so-called Spanish flu pandemic in the early days of World War I.
And there's probably some way of estimating the number of excess deaths that result from conditions of the sort we had in Los Angeles a few months ago, where people were waiting in the streets in ambulances for 10 hours because there was no place for them in a hospital, people deciding not to go in and get checked, though they have chest pains, because they're afraid that they would get infected out in public or in the hospital. Can you speak to that, Dr. Fox?
Yes, and I can't tell you the exact numbers. They vary significantly in different locations based on the characteristics of the population. But I know from my own experience of talking to residents in Greenlee County, where I have been quite involved in the pandemic response, that many people were staying away from the hospital, staying away from healthcare facilities, afraid that they might catch COVID. And so we're not having their chronic medical problems addressed. And that's resulted across the nation in those excess deaths, as you correctly term them, from all the other medical conditions that are not being treated adequately. And that's on top of the now over 550 million deaths that have occurred in the U.S. from COVID-19 itself.
550,000, I think. You said million.
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. 550,000 deaths over, right?
Yes. Dr. Fox, what advice can you offer to a person who shows no symptoms, has not been vaccinated, and wonders how to evaluate contrasting recommendations that circulate publicly? On the one hand, to maintain coronavirus safe practices, to register, to be vaccinated as soon as possible, and encourage everybody else to do likewise. On the other hand, advice to relax, take advantage of reopenings of businesses, go to restaurants, get your kids back into school in classrooms, live a normal life, live as if the crisis has passed. What would you tell a person who's trying to decide, how should I live?
Well, I don't believe that the crisis has passed. I think we had seen an improvement primarily due to the advent of, or the adherence to the public health practices and to the increasing number of vaccinations. But in general, I would encourage people to follow the science-based recommendations. If we are going to see a time, and we will, but to see a time where we can return to the more normal activities that we all wish to, we have to follow those recommendations. First and foremost is get vaccinated. Take whichever vaccine you can get as soon as you can. Maintain the other public health measures in the meantime, wearing a mask in public, an effective mask, and wearing it correctly, not below your nose, practicing the social distancing, avoiding groups, trying to stay out of poorly ventilated rooms, and practicing good hand hygiene. None of these are 100%, but they all help. And that's what's necessary in order for our nation to reach a point where we can return to our activities.
Testing is available free in a number of ways. People can drive into a pharmacy. There are free home tests now for people who can go to the correct site on the internet and answer a few questions and have a test sent to them. Dr. Fox, under what conditions should people be tested? Can you speak a little bit to the different options for testing and when a test is advisable now?
Yes, there is much more availability of testing now, at least in terms of the kinds of tests that are out there. Unlike the early days of the pandemic, when it was extremely difficult and to get tested, and the turnaround time was quite extensive. The primary situations where testing is valuable is in the first and foremost is in contact tracing. In other words, the assessment and evaluation of the possible exposures to a known coronavirus or COVID-19 case. It's extremely valuable there in helping to identify who else should be isolated, who should be quarantined, and helps you track down those what are called secondary cases, that next generation of infected persons. That's, I think, it's one of its greatest values, the value of testing. It's also useful in situations of employment or schools, return to work, where that assures the workforce or this, especially teachers, for example, at schools, that they're in a more safe environment than they would be otherwise. For individuals who want to be tested, there are some reasons to do that. Are you going to be traveling? Are you going to be attending a family get together? Those sorts of things may be a good reason to have testing performed. But remember when you do that, the testing is a snapshot in time. It's not a clean bill of health. It's not a get out of jail free card. It only tells you that on the day you tested, you did not have measurable levels of the virus or of the markers for it. It does not mean that you had not already contracted it and are in what's called a pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, in other words, no symptom phase, and it's that you could come down with it in a few days. In the meantime, it's possible to spread it. So you always have to take negative test results with a grain of salt.
So if a person were going to travel, let's say, to a grandchild's graduation from high school, and that person got tested 4 days before the trip, got results a day before the trip that said negative. Nevertheless, though that person might have the assurance that, so far as I know now, I'm not going to go and spread the coronavirus to everybody in my family gathering, that person would also be well advised to wear a mask, wash hands frequently, do everything that can be done to prevent the spread of the virus, even so.
That's correct, Jamie. And that's what I do. Even when I go over to Arizona to work in the public health effort there, and although I've been fully vaccinated, I still mask in all my encounters. I still practice good hand hygiene. I maintain social distancing. And part of that is to protect me, but also because I still can get mild illness even after the vaccination, but it's also to protect those who I see who are more vulnerable than me, that I don't pass on to them something that the illness in those pre-symptomatic stages.
Understood. President Biden held a press conference on the 65th day of his presidency with a new goal of 200 million vaccinations in the U.S. by his 100th day in office, April 30th. The 2.5 million shots that are now being given daily seem to put us on track to reach or exceed that goal. With that in mind, can you tell us what is meant by herd immunity? What would it take to reach herd immunity in the United States, and what unwise policies or other obstacles could defeat that effort?
Well, herd immunity is the idea that a large enough percentage of the population who is at risk have immunological protection from the disease, and such a large number that there are few people who have been uninfected, and it's difficult for a person with the illness, to pass it, to find someone, and to pass it on to someone who has not had it yet. The two ways to achieve herd immunity is either from vaccination, and that's traditionally what we do with our common childhood illnesses for which kids get vaccinated, or from recovering from the illness itself. And although many people have recommended, or at least at times in the past have recommended, well, let's just let everybody get it and we'll get herd immunity, that's not a benign process, as we know, that millions of people will get hospitalized and die as a result of that. It's not clear exactly how many people or what percentage of the population is necessary to achieve herd immunity. The numbers that we mostly hear about are 70, 80, 85%, but that varies somewhat because of the ability of the virus to mutate and become more transmissible, so that people who have had and recovered from COVID earlier might now be susceptible again. This happened in parts of Brazil where substantial numbers of people had been struck, had been ill with COVID-19 early in the pandemic, and they thought they had herd immunity. But the new P1 variety arose there, and now many of those people are becoming ill a second time. So that herd immunity is a moving figure, but it is somewhere in that 80% range. We aren't there yet, and with 200 vaccinations out, we'll be getting close, but with much of the vaccine requiring two doses, that's really fully vaccinating only 100 million people out of our 300, let's say nominally 330 million in the United States. So we will not have reached herd immunity based on vaccinations. There are some additional number, and that's hard to know, somewhere between 50, 100 million people have in the United States have already contracted COVID-19. They have some degree of protection, although not nearly the degree that the vaccine gives. But we're still not at herd immunity yet. Hopefully, as we continue to vaccinate people by summer, assuming that we get enough uptake and acceptance of the vaccine, we would be there.
And I'd asked what obstacles, either individual or community behavior or unwise decisions about public health policies, might stand in the way of that. That may be too broad a question to answer, but I'm thinking of decisions such as that made by Governor Greg Abbott in Texas to fully open up at a time when there are surges happening here, there, and yonder around in Texas, seems to be an invitation to have another wave of infections in Texas, or just lack of awareness in, I believe it's the city of Manaus in Brazil, one that you were referring to, where about 70% of those people had had the coronavirus. And the last news I saw, which is fairly recent, they were in the terrible situation that doctors hate to contemplate, where they're operating at crisis standards, and everyday doctors are making decisions about who gets oxygen and who will die, who gets to go into the ICU and who will die. And that's probably not directly anybody's fault, except that they thought they were home free and conditions changed, and suddenly the whole population of 2 million or so in that city is at risk.
You're right. That's a really terrible situation that's existing there and overwhelming their healthcare facilities, and having to make those terrible decisions about who gets treatment and who doesn't, knowing that many of the people who don't are going to die. In the case of states in the United States that are opening up, I agree with Dr. Walensky, the new director of the Centers for Disease Control, and that we need to be cautious about that. I know there's a lot of desire to reach a point of where our businesses, our daily activities are more normalized. But with the advent of the new more easily transmissible strains, and the fact that we have not reached adequate vaccination yet, we're very likely to see an increase in cases, especially in those states or areas that open prematurely.
I think I heard her say only yesterday, if people can hold on even another month to month and a half, 2 months, as we get vaccinations out, which we're doing at a rapid rate, we may be able to do a reopening that we can hold to. But if there's a reopening now and people lay down the mitigation measures they've been adhering to, we may condemn ourselves to a whole new, very serious and deadly surge.
Yep, and that's quite possible, Jamie. And it's, you know, this virus and the whole pandemic has been such a learning experience. It's uncharted territory for us. We've not had anything like this since the early part of the 20th century with the influenza pandemic that hit. We do know is that vaccination, if people will, enough people get vaccinated, that provides such good protection, even against the newer strains, that does give hold out the promise that we can reach a point of where the pandemic numbers have decreased, where we can resume normal activity. The protection from having recovered from the virus, while protective, is not nearly as thorough or nearly as effective as that which follows after becoming fully vaccinated. And so all those measures are still necessary for a time. And that'll be coupled on top of the typical seasonal nature of this kind of virus, which will decrease in the summer. Although last summer we saw an uptick in numbers because of simply the lack of compliance with common sense public health measures at that time.
And that's a reasonable anxiety, Dr. Fox, it seems to me, because we've already seen just during spring break, people who have felt so constrained, massing together in some places in the country without masks, without any kind of social distance, pressing together and disregarding even police orders to disperse and constituting then a threat to public health. And if in the summertime there is the myth spread around, we don't have to worry about this because the virus always recedes in the summer and people start packing together in swimming pools and beaches, that human behavior might defeat the virus's, in a sense, own attempt to back off, don't you think?
That's correct. You know, if we had an increase in the number of people willing to get vaccinated, to become fully vaccinated, we could see much more likelihood of getting together in those groups, especially in smaller groups with people you know have been sensible about public health measures and have been fully vaccinated. And that, in fact, is the recommendation or the guidelines of the CDC currently for people who have been fully vaccinated and 2 weeks beyond their last, when the maximum effect of their immune response has occurred, they can safely get together with other people in the same situation who have been following sensible precautions without a mask, can share the same space, can share a meal, can watch TV on the couch together, those sorts of things. And we can expect that to extend to larger groups with more people being vaccinated.
I want to turn attention to specific vaccines, but just one more question about herd immunity first, because I think there is a simple, perhaps, misconception that herd immunity just means so many of us are immune that the vaccine doesn't have a chance. And maybe a little more specifically, Dr. Fox, doesn't herd immunity mean that the vaccine doesn't really have any good place to find a host and an opportunity to replicate itself and to mutate, because so many people that it might lodge in are immune, so their own immune systems will overcome it. And there are very many fewer opportunities for the vaccine to reproduce and in that process mutate in a way that enables it to become more pernicious rather than to fizzle out.
Well, yes, and you're actually talking about the virus there that replicating. The one thing that I think people don't realize is that being immune from the vaccine is not like your own personal backyard blood bug zapper. It doesn't kill the virus before it ever gets to you. It only works when you catch the virus. And then the idea is that your immune system kicks in so efficiently and effectively that as the virus is increasing in numbers, your immune system is rapidly acting to push its numbers down. So theoretically, there is a period of time when you could be making virus and even transmitting it to someone else. But the effectiveness of these viruses, of these vaccines, is so great that that's thought to be a relatively brief period.
Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, they're all messenger RNA vaccines, different from the flu and measles vaccines we're accustomed to. So Dr. Fred Fox, how do these vaccines work? Is risk being vaccinated? And let me ask a question. Are these vaccines seen that they think is most effective or safest, or should they take the first available vaccine?
Well, that's a really interesting question. If we look at traditional vaccines, the ones we've been familiar with, things like measles, mumps, rubella, influenza, tetanus, these are all vaccines that are based on injecting a portion or the entire virus, which has been killed, weakened, or split into parts, and that's injected in as the vaccine into our arms, where it then elicits an immune response. The messenger RNA vaccines, it's a platform that's been around for quite a while. And in this case, what happens, there's no virus that's injected at all. Instead, the gene, the genetic information that's used to make the spike protein, that protuberance that we've all seen on the diagrams of the coronavirus, the genetic code or information for that is reproduced, much like a 3D printer is, artificially. That artificial genetic code for that protein is then encapsulated in some fats. That allows it to be stable enough to be injected into our arm. There, it's taken up by our muscle cells, and the little piece of genetic code takes over and is produced, the protein machinery in those our muscle cells. In all our 37 trillion cells right now, we all are making hundreds to thousands of proteins every second using that same machinery. This messenger RNA simply slips in there and makes some spike protein along with the rest of the protein. But that system is unbelievably efficient and very intolerant of any error. So within a couple of hours, that messenger RNA is completely broken down. The protein that's made, the spike protein, is released from the outside of our muscle cell, either attached to the outside of that cell or into the bloodstream. And there, in those two places, it now elicits our immune response. But even that protein, just like any other foreign protein that we're exposed to thousands of times a day that we breathe in through the air, that is broken down and eliminated as well. But the difference is we've made an immune response to it. So that's the messenger RNA. The Johnson & Johnson is very similar, but it's not a messenger RNA. What it is it has taken essentially a dead viral capsule, if you will. It's the envelope of that virus, a common cold virus. It can't replicate. It's been changed. And a portion of its DNA has been, again, with the same process, much like a 3D printer, had inserted that code for the spike protein. That then makes the protein. The virus itself is eliminated from our cells, the virus envelope. The spike protein is also then manufactured and secreted to the outside of the cell in the bloodstream. So the end result is that same protein, the spike protein, elicits our strong immune response. So that's the background and the way these messenger RNAs and the protein or the protein generating vaccine from Johnson & Johnson work. People are concerned and say, well, these were developed so fast, they're not safe, we don't know about them. But in fact, the process of using messenger RNA vaccines and the research has been going on for over a decade. And already vaccines were developed for Ebola and tested, were actually approved by the FDA, just were never used widely because the Ebola vaccine, that Ebola pandemic waned. Same for Zika virus. There's vaccines out there for rabies, and also they're testing one's messenger RNA for influenza and others now. The only reason this came up occurred over a quick period was that the regulatory portion of it was shortened. They did not take any shortcuts. It's typically what happens is there's about three meetings of these committees a year. And so one committee will meet, and then it's several months before they meet again. They simply pushed those meetings closer together, which allowed more rapid approval. The same process occurred, though. So the safety data on the trials was quite good. There was no untoward significant effects noted. I was convinced of that. I attended distantly those hearings and watched and listened to all the evidence. I was convinced it was safe. And so I took the first vaccine offered in Greenlee County, where I am the medical director of the health department, and did so publicly because I believed they were safe and effective.
And so in terms of risk, how would you characterize the risk of being vaccinated as opposed to the risk of possibly contracting the coronavirus itself?
Well, one way to look at that is to look at the now literally millions of Americans who have received the vaccine. And if you go back to when the trials started last summer, and you look at all those millions of Americans and continuing now in the vaccination efforts that are going on, and if you look at those individuals who completed their two-dose series and were beyond the 2 weeks that it takes after the second one for that immune response to maximize, of those millions of people, nobody was sick enough to be put in the ICU. Zero. Nobody died. And only a handful of people were even ill enough to be hospitalized. The vaccine doesn't mean you will never get COVID. It just means you will never get seriously ill enough that you're likely to be in the ICU or even hospitalized or to die. Now, in contrast, look at the millions of Americans who have contracted COVID since the pandemic started who did not have vaccine first. Of those, millions were hospitalized and over 500,000 died. So the difference in the outcome from disease and in those people who've been vaccinated versus not vaccinated and were infected with SARS coronavirus is just incredible. These vaccines are unbelievably effective, far exceeded the hopes of what they would be. They exceed the efficacy of most of the vaccines we already have. The only one that even approaches it is the measles vaccine.
If you've just joined us, this is the Coronavirus Update interview of March 31, 2021 on KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, and streaming on the World Wide Web at gmcr.org. I'm Jamie Newton with Dr. Fred Fox, a longtime resident of Grant County, who practiced medicine here for many years and has served as the medical director of Greenlee County, Arizona for the past 17 years. Let's turn our attention now, Dr. Fox, to the struggle to understand the vaccines. Scientists and health officials attempt to help the public distinguish between valid information about vaccines and invalid or misleading publicity. Misinformation, just wrong stuff, even disinformation, deliberate falsehoods and distortions. Should people be concerned about any of the apprehensions that are being raised by what one might call vaccine-resistant publicists?
Well, I think people should always carefully evaluate anything, but I think that they should use the best available information when they do so. In medicine, if you just look at my career, the things that I learned early on in my career that I held dear to my heart, that I thought were set in stone, I gave up as new and better information came around. And I think that's important in this situation, too. I've looked carefully at much of the science and medical literature about these vaccines and about the illness. There's lots of misinformation and misleading information that's circulating. And I think people need to try to evaluate the source of that information. I personally want to look at good medical and scientific information. Much of what circulates tends to be negative, especially in some of the social media. And there was a recent article or research publication that looked at that and how much of even within the legitimate press and the legitimate media that the tendency was to stress the negative aspects. I think it's important to recognize that much of what you see is sort of parroting of the same story by someone over and over and over again, and you must take that with a grain of salt.
Let's turn our attention to healthcare disparities. Here in the Southwest, nationally and globally, the director of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, has emphasized since the very beginning of the pandemic that the privileged can be as safe from the coronavirus only as the poorest and most vulnerable. We're really in this together. And right now, the U.S. and other rich countries are being criticized by epidemiologists for prioritizing vaccination and care of their own populations to the relative disregard of the world's poor. How do you see, and in your experience as a practicing doctor in this area where there are a lot of poor people and people without adequate health insurance, how do you see healthcare disparities, including racial ethnic injustices, systemic injustice, affecting pandemic control here in this area, and how does that shape things that happen worldwide as well?
Well, first, I think look at who, there's two types of way of looking at risk from COVID. There, one is what is the risk of contracting? And that clearly is high in certain occupations, healthcare workers, for example, the so-called frontline essential workers, people like that. There's also risk when you look at who is at most at risk of serious illness and death. And that has to do with certain medical conditions, such as diabetes, heart disease, pre-existing lung disease, et cetera. But one of the biggest risk factors for serious illness and death is poverty, is being disadvantaged. And although unfortunately that's been assigned or ascribed to being a racial characteristic, it's not racial. It's a direct consequence of racism. It's racism that creates the conditions that allow people of an ethnic group to be much more susceptible and to have poorer outcomes. That's true across the world, and it's true in the United States and in this state. In the early days of the pandemic here in New Mexico, the population that was most dramatically affected was the Navajo Nation and some of the other Native American nations. And that's a direct result of the disparities that they experienced as a result of generations of racism, the lack of widespread medical care, even though the Indian Health Service attempts to do an excellent job, the poverty that existed, the lack of adequate food sources, all the things that happened. One of my sons volunteered in the Navajo Nation for 5 weeks and witnessed that firsthand and the tremendous grief and sorrow that resulted. So what we have tried to do here or in Arizona, in the county where I've been involved in, yes, we followed the original priority groups of trying to immunize healthcare workers, but then we moved on to elderly and then tried hard to identify those elderly living in poverty. We used a number of methods to do that. We, through the health department, we looked at the lists of people who were homebound, who received home services and reached out to them, even making home visits to vaccinate them. We tried to reach out to persons who did not have internet access and thus couldn't get on the online portals to register. So those sorts of things. We've been somewhat successful at that, although we haven't reached everybody. But those are important people to get vaccinated because they will suffer an increased burden of the outcome, a negative outcome of this pandemic. And I think that what the U.S. is starting to do with donating some vaccine to other companies needs to continue in a major fashion. And I think we should be looking at trying to ramp up our production capabilities, not just for our own population, but for to be used worldwide.
This is not really a question of just great generosity or altruism, is it, Dr. Fox? It is that, but also that in this sense, we really are a global community. And if there is a place like this very vulnerable region of Brazil, where suddenly there are surges of newer, more pernicious variants, that will come back to bite us.
It's true, and it already is. And we are likely to see, you know, this as terrible as this pandemic has been, we should not be complacent about it. It is not the last. We have disrupted our natural world to such a degree that we've created the situation, the environment, where many more of these crossover infections, zoonotic infections, that come from animal populations into humans are likely to occur. And they affect everybody. They don't just occur in poverty-stricken areas. They occur in Western countries and more developed nations as well. And we need to really work together and address the health and needs of the entire world in order to protect the entire world from the ravages of further pandemics, which are going to occur to some degree.
In our last few minutes, I'd like to ask you about the long COVID, long hauler trends. Something like a quarter, perhaps more, of COVID-19 patients who are sick enough to be hospitalized and then are discharged as recovered report continuing symptoms after their discharge, such things as brain fog, confusion, memory loss, shortness of breath, damage to heart, kidneys, other organs. Dr. Fox, what can you tell us about long-term health impacts of the coronavirus?
Well, this is a very concerning situation, and it's another strong reason for people to become vaccinated. Because what's in addition to helping to prevent this syndrome of long hauler condition, there's also been some early studies that show that people who had long hauler symptoms of long haulers who were subsequently vaccinated improved. So the vaccination seems to be helping that. It's not clear why. But the long hauler syndrome is not a single disease. It is a whole constellation of multiple overlapping situations. Some people get one symptom or another. Some people get a number of them. And we're uncertain how long these are going to last yet. It hasn't been going on long enough to know. Will many of these clear in a few months? Is it a sort of moderate intermediate length chronic condition, or is it longer? Some of the research is suggesting at least some of these conditions are longer. There was a study recently of several hundred patients who had been hospitalized, not all of them seriously ill, but hospitalized nonetheless. And they followed them up studying their cardiac condition with echocardiograms or ultrasounds of the heart and of MRIs of the heart. And what they discovered was that 40% of the people in that series had structural defects of the heart. Now, what I mean by structural defects is the heart muscle itself had been changed. And the concern of this is one of the known risk factors for the subsequent development of heart failure. So are these people going to heal, or are they going to become then individuals who develop heart failure? So there's a lot of unknowns here, but it's very concerning and could actually end up being a much bigger problem over the long term than the acute illness itself.
Well, on that cautionary note, let's conclude. You've been listening to the Coronavirus Update interview of March 31st, 2021. And my guest has been Dr. Fred Fox. He's a longtime resident of Grant County who practiced medicine here for many years and for the past 17 years has served as the medical director of Greenlee County, Arizona. Dr. Fox, thank you so very much for speaking to our listeners.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to do so. It's been a wonderful experience.
This interview will be posted for listening at your convenience and downloading right here on the Coronavirus Update page of our website, gmcr.org, and also on the Comprehensive Resource website, grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org. That's a collaboration among a group of community organizations here in Grant County. Thanks, as always, to Marcus Hansen, our station manager and audio engineer and producer of Coronavirus Update. And thank you for listening and for supporting GMCR and KURU. Be safe and be well. For Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, I'm Jamie Newt.